Good evening.
Good evening.
I really love coming down to Santa Cruz. I went to school here up the hill, so it's kind of a treat to come back. First of all, I think it's kind of obvious that I'm not so well versed in this tradition. Please excuse any faux pas of mine. Kukyo-san said that I was Lama Jerry. Does anyone know what a Lama is?
A monk.
A monk? Anyone else?
An animal like a camel?
Yeah, I was wondering to see if we'd get any Peruvian livestock. Yeah. A fire in Boston? Well, it's originally Lama. It's the Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit word guru. And while the Sanskrit term still seems to hold some sort of sacrosanct meaning, Lama has, I feel like the word Lama has degenerated. and it's because of a lot of different reasons. One is that it has become a very broad term used by Tibetans, and oftentimes they will use it to refer to anyone who is wearing robes, be they actually a lama or not. They just say, you know, Tashi Dalai Lama La. And also in Nepal, there is an entire ethnic group called the Tamang, and within this ethnic group, there is an entire caste called the Lama caste. And so everyone in this sort of ethnic group has the last name Lama. So I once in Nepal, I met a Tamang fellow, and he said, "Oh, you're a Lama, huh? I'm a Lama too." But basically, to be called a Lama, your teacher decides that you are ready and or capable to begin teaching others to some degree or another. One very traditional way to sort of gain this title is by doing a traditional 3-year, 3-month meditation retreat, which is a cloistered meditation retreat where you go into a room or a set of rooms and they lock the door and don't let you out until the time has gone by. And so I did that. And afterwards, when I came out, my guru, my lama, started saying things like, "Hey Lama, come over here. Hey Lama, go do that." And at first I thought he was joking. I still think he was joking. Because he had this grin on his face, like I'm messing with you. But then other people started noticing that he was calling me Lama. And so they started calling me Lama, Lama Jerry. And he didn't stop them. So that's how I sort of got the title Lama. Although not everyone who is called Lama has done a 3-year meditation retreat, and because their teachers thought that they were ready to teach even without that. And not everyone who's done a 3-year meditation retreat is called a Lama if their teacher doesn't want them to hold that title. And it's not even a matter of them not being ready, but it can also be a matter of whether your teacher needs people to teach. So that is in brief about Lama. I was born here in California. I grew up in New Mexico and Texas mostly. I went to school in at UC Santa Cruz. And afterwards, went straight to Nepal because, well, everyone was asking me, so what are you going to do now that you have this BA degree? You're going to get a job? No. Don't really want to do that. Oh, so you're going to go back to school? Oh, gosh, no. Please, no more school. And so I went to Nepal to learn more about this Buddhism. I had taken some classes by Raoul Birnbaum up on campus. And I was still really interested in that. So I went to Nepal. I met Chukinima Rinpoche, and we had a pretty good connection. Ended up staying for 12 years. And he had a Buddhist college there. At the time it was called the Rongjung Yeshe Institute. But now it's Kathmandu University's Buddhist Studies campus. And they offer BA degrees, MA degrees, and even a PhD now, I think. And so he had this school that he just started, and I kind of went to him and said, so you got this school. Yeah, I just finished school. But I see you have this school. Is it really something I should check out? I was kind of hoping to get out of school. And he said, well, if you want to learn about Buddhism, and someone's already created a school, and all you have to do is show up, it'd be intelligent of you to do so.
So by the way, I just have to interject. This yeah. For those who know Shoho, this is where she is right now.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Same school.
And so I kind of gritted my teeth and joined the school. I ended up studying for 5 years there, and afterwards I was given permission to do this 3-year retreat, during which time I did a lot of chanting of mantras and visualizing deities. And at the end I came out and was sort of informally given this title, Lama, and then I got a job at the same school as their student counselor and social event planner and meditation instructor. My wife and I recently moved to Berkeley, maybe a year and a half ago, so she could pursue a PhD in Buddhist Studies at UC Berkeley. And I teach and talk about Buddhism to anyone who cares to listen, which includes over Skype. I have some students in Maine. And I paint houses. I paint and plaster houses for a living. I guess I wanted to talk to you guys about a bit about Tibetan Buddhism. Koki was saying that perhaps some of you here were quite familiar with the Zen tradition, but not necessarily so familiar with other traditions, and so I thought I might talk about another tradition. Me being one who's familiar with another tradition and not so familiar with the Zen tradition. Although it's beautiful. I really like it here. So what I wanted to talk about today was the nine yanas, or the nine vehicles. And in the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, they break Buddhism down into nine vehicles. And the first three vehicles are, I suspect that some of you are familiar with them. The first one is the Shravaka Yana, or the Shravaka vehicle. And this Shravaka vehicle is It's also known as the sort of ground vehicle, or the base vehicle, or sort of the foundation. There's another way it's described by other traditions. Sometimes it's referred to as the Hinayana, which means the lesser vehicle, which you could say makes sense from a certain perspective, but it's also not so polite. So, but it's what's commonly practiced in Thailand and Burma and such places, the Theravada tradition. And it's said that they, it's said by the Tibetans at least, that they have recognized the emptiness of self, but have not yet recognized the emptiness of phenomena. So, and that their main practice, or at least the main aspect of the Theravada tradition, the Shravaka tradition, that the Tibetans really sort of hold up and venerate, is the tradition of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And so whenever Tibetans engage in any kind of Buddhist practice, whether it's meditation or chanting or whatever, they'll always start with this sort of foundation of taking refuge. Also, if anyone has questions, please raise your hand. I'm happy to be somewhat casual about this. The second of these nine vehicles is the Pratyeka Buddhayana. And they're very similar to the Shravakayana. Often the two are sort of included together, this Pratyeka, or this, how would you translate it? The solitary realizer, the vehicle of the solitary realizers. And so it's often described that they're often described as having no teachers. Of course they had teachers, but they had teachers in a previous life. And so you don't see them interacting with the teachers, but based on interactions from past lives, they're able to attain high levels of realization. And it's said that they recognize both the emptiness of self and half the emptiness of phenomena. How you can recognize the half the emptiness of phenomena is a little bit tricky to work out philosophically, but I know some people who can explain that very clearly. The third of these vehicles is one I'm guessing most, if not all of you, are somewhat familiar with. Anyone want to hazard a guess? Think of something that ends with yana. Anyone? Mahayana. Very good. Very good. It's actually in the Oxford English Dictionary. So it's English. Yeah. And so while the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas are striving to attain enlightenment for their own aims, the Mahayana, which is the, you could translate as the greater vehicle or the great vehicle, is greater primarily because of its greater motivation, its greater altruism, in that practitioners of the Mahayana pledge themselves to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And within this Mahayana tradition, both the Zen tradition and the Tibetan tradition are Mahayana traditions, so we're in the same tradition. Within this tradition, there are three types of motivation that a bodhisattva, one traveling this Mahayana path, can generate in order to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. And the first type of motivation is that of a king or a queen. And so that particular motivation is to say, I will attain enlightenment first, and then everyone can come after me. I'll you know, help them up the mountain, up towards me, you know, up into the castle. First myself, and then everyone else. And the scriptures say that to train with this type of motivation takes, I believe, 21 incalculably long eons to accomplish, which is great because it means you'll get there. It does take a little while. The second motivation is that of a ferryman, and I wanted to say ferry woman, but then ferry woman suddenly had other connotations, especially for those of you who watch True Blood. Sophie Stackhouse she's a fairy. Anyway, but anyway, that of a fairy man or a fairy person. Oh, perfect. Thank you. You saved the day. Saved my day. And so this fairy person says, okay, everybody on the boat, let's go across together. We'll all get there at the same time. And so everybody sort of piles in and they go off at the same time. And it said that a bodhisattva who practices the path with this type of motivation will accomplish perfect Buddhahood within 7 kalpas, 7 incalculably long eons. The third type of motivation is that of a shepherd. So I don't have to get into man or woman on that one. It's shepherd. And a shepherd is someone who makes sure that the entire flock of sheep has gotten into the pen before he or she enters the pen behind them and closes the gate. So everyone else attains enlightenment before me, and then I will be the last one to just slip in before they close the gate. I don't know if they ever close the gate, but and it said that someone who travels the path, the Mahayana path, with this motivation will accomplish perfect enlightenment in 3 kalpas. And this was actually the motivation that the Buddha of our time, Buddha Shakyamuni, generated when he was traveling the Bodhisattva path in his previous lifetimes. And so that sort of sums up the previous 3 kalpas of Buddha Shakyamuni's incarnations. Although interesting to note, if you really think about it, none of these scenarios actually quite works. You can't get there first and then say, now everybody come, because people don't always want to come, or some people are going to get there before you, or the whole idea of the fairy person. It can also be kind of problematic, and also the shepherd. I mean, how can you make everyone else go before you if you haven't actually been there yourself before? So if you want to get very critical, and sometimes they do this in Tibetan Buddhism and in philosophy classes and in debate classes, so they really analyze things like this. None of them are actually possible, but the idea is the motivation, to have that type of motivation, to be willing to let someone else's happiness go before yours, or let someone else's progress go before yours. And the main practice of the Mahayana, what is the main practice What would you guess is the main practice? Emptiness. Good. That's part of it. Anyone else? There's six of them.
Giving, generosity, ethics.
You could say that's one of them. But yes, it's the six perfections. Or the six prajnaparamitas, the six transcendent perfections, which are generosity, discipline, patience, diligence, meditation, or you could say mindfulness, or you could say concentration, and wisdom. And this last one, wisdom, that's the prajna in prajnaparamita. And to practice the prajnaparamitas, the previous six paramitas, the only way to do so perfectly is to integrate that prajna, that wisdom, into each one. So then they each become the wisdom of generosity, the wisdom of discipline, and so forth. But the last one, the wisdom, is one that's meant to be combined with each of the others to practice them in a complete way. So those were the first three of these nine jhanas. And the remaining six are primarily practiced in the Tibetan tradition. So this is a Tibeto-centric explanation. Although, and they are basically the tantric aspects, you know, the aspects of tantric Buddhism. And there are some forms of tantra, Buddhist tantra, practiced in Japan and Korea and other places, possibly also China. And they're divided into the outer tantras and the inner tantras. So then the middle three, say 4, 5, and 6, are the outer tantras of Kriya, Yoga, and Charya. Kriya, Yoga, Charya. And in these practices, we're starting to get into deity practices, which are really common in Tibetan Buddhism. In the outer tantras, they're performing more external visualizations. So you're visualizing an enlightened form, such as Buddha Shakyamuni, in the sky before you. And you know, singing his praises and making offerings, both real and also imagined, and also chanting his mantra, and sitting in meditation, and then at the end dedicating the merit so that it will continue to be of benefit, to proliferate, as it were. And in these outer tantras, sometimes the difference between them is described in the closeness one feels with the deity, whether it's the deity is sort of like a teacher up there looking down to me, or whether it's the teacher is somehow like sort of an equal with me. To even the teacher, the deity and I are like really close friends, you know. I was actually trying to read up on the outer tantras, wondering why I hadn't read so much about them before, or heard so much about them before, and that's because they're not practiced anymore, really. For the most part, you can find some aspects of them here and there, but they're not practiced very much in Buddhist tantra, because these three outer and six inner tantras, they're actually in, I guess you could say they were put in sort of a chronological order that they would be most helpful. And so it's these first three were said to be most helpful in various previous ages, whereas these last three, the three inner tantras, which are sometimes in some traditions combined as one and some explained as three, were supposed to be of most benefit and most helpful during the Dark Age, the Kali Yuga, which we are currently in, the age of degeneration. So, regarding these inner tantras, they get kind of interesting, for me at least. All the practices in these tantras would begin with the foundation of taking refuge in the three jewels and in generating the motivation of altruistic thought of the benefit of all beings. But then the practices change a bit. In the first of the inner tantras, which is called Maha Yoga, there's Maha, Anu, and Ati. And then in Maha Yoga, the main practice is known as the development stage, where instead of visualizing the deity as someone outside of yourself, you're visualizing yourself as the deity. So you're visualizing yourself in the form of the Buddha, or a particular Buddha or a Bodhisattva, for example, or even a wrathful deity with flames and holding weapons. And the idea is that we're training in associating or even transforming our ordinary body, speech, and mind into the enlightened body, speech, and mind of the deity, of the Buddha. And so, from that perspective, we're actually practicing being enlightened right now. Practicing, having the Buddha's form with our body and chanting the Buddha's speech by chanting his mantra, and with our minds trying to rest in our own innate Buddha nature. And so this is the main practice in the Maha Yoga. And in the second of these inner tantras, it's known as Anu Yoga, and you can see basically the deities are getting closer and closer and closer to us. Like we're already visualizing ourselves as a deity. In Anu Yoga, we're actually visualizing the deity inside of ourselves. Oh, that was me. I was wondering who's doing that. So, we're visualizing the deities inside of ourselves. In particular, we're visualizing various deities and various energetic channels and centers within the body. And there are exercises in which we train in manipulating these subtle energies that flow through these channels and these centers. And in particular, we learn to reverse the energies. And this would include such practices as Tummo, which is a practice whereby you can generate an intense inner heat. It's very blissful, and it feels nice, but it also has a way of causing any other sort of obvious negative emotions or whatnot to just sort of pass out because the feeling, the sensation is so intense. And Tibetans are actually able to, not just Tibetans, also people from many cultures are able to practice this in such a way that not only do they feel this heat internally, but it also radiates externally, and you can actually not just heat a room, but you can melt snow with it. And there's traditions of in the middle of winter in Tibet, taking a long white cloth and dunking it in, it's in the middle of the night, and you dunk it in a barrel of water, and it's freezing cold in Tibet, especially in the winter. And as you have to break the ice over the barrel to get the cloth in, And then as you're pulling it out of the water, it's already freezing. And then so you have to kind of break the ice in the cloth, and you kind of wrap it around yourself. And you sit and practice this meditation on the subtle channels and energies in the body, and create enough heat to actually dry the sheet. And you'll see just steam rising off in the air. You'll see them melt rings of snow around themselves, and the steam and rises off. And when the sheet is dried, and they wet it again, and they do it all over again. And people will come from, you know, miles and from valleys to come witness this. It's kind of exciting to watch. And so that's what's part of what happens in Anu Yoga. And then the final of these three inner tantras is called Ati Yoga. And it is often referred to as Dzogchen, or the great perfection. Has anyone heard Kokyo mention the words great perfection? Or Dzogchen? Yeah. And so, in this tradition, it's hard to say anything at all. As soon as you open your mouth, it's wrong. But it's basically keeping in mind that I'm opening my mouth right now. A tradition of resting in our own innate Buddha nature, our own basic simplicity, completely unadorned of any trappings of thought or negative emotions. Just completely naked. Bright, clear, and awake without getting involved in thoughts whatsoever. And so Kokyo-san and I have met at some of these retreats up at a Dharma Center called Rongjin Yeshe Gomde. It's on the 101, about halfway between Ukiah and Eureka. So that was, in short, the nine vehicles of Tibetan Buddhism. In particular, of the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Any questions or comments? Or yes, please.
You spoke about the kind of the first two inner yama practices, kind of in terms of practices. But Dzogchen, what would you say about in terms of?
Yeah, I mean, what I said kind of was about practice. It's a sort of a complete letting go. There is no visualization. There is no recitation. It's letting everything else just drop off completely.
So are these stages building one upon the other? Do you
yes.
practice the, you know, some, I don't know if you would think of them as preliminary practices leading up to Dzogchen.
Absolutely. Basically, this Ati Yoga, this Dzogchen, they're saying that's it. That is enlightenment. And if you can rest in that constantly, without distraction, day and night, you are the Buddha. If that is in any way difficult for you, maybe you should try some other methods as well. Hey, look, we have a whole list of other methods you can try. So Tibetans kind of pride themselves on how many methods they have, and it can be kind of crazy-making to figure out which one is the right one for you. But yes, it's said that if one can rest in the nature of mind undistractedly, then it is very good to do so, to rest in one's Buddha nature undistractedly. It's very good to do so, but if not, then one should engage in these other practices that they involve a little bit more form, you know, something to hold on to, because Dzogchen, it's completely effortless, and it's completely without artifice, and that's completely not what we're used to. It's we're used to acting, and it is non-action. We're used to meditating, and Dzogchen is described as non-meditation. So it's kind of a complete about face, and that can be difficult for a lot of people. And so that's why there are these other various paths. Tibetans are fond of saying that there are 84,000 different types of disturbing emotions. And for that reason, the Buddha has taught 84,000 methods to reach enlightenment. So there are many different paths, deities to meditate upon, depending on one's own personal inclinations or connections or whatsoever. But they all lead to the same endpoint. I believe someone over here had a question. Sorry.
Are there any extant texts that, or is there a place in extant texts where you can say this was this period of regression and actually
all texts
that you meet during regressionary period?
What do you mean a regressionary period?
Oh, you mentioned this term,
Kali Yuga.
Kali Yuga.
This age of degeneration, yes.
Yeah, so are there any extant texts that mention that term and feel that they were in that era or weren't in that era, or that we can say stepping back without them actually saying that?
Yes, definitely. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly when the age of degeneration began. Because it's all sort of, I don't know, it's like it's written in code, you know? They say there's a degeneration of lifespan, a degeneration of attention span. You know, there's many different degenerations. And also an age of opulence, when there's so many cool things like iPhones floating around that it's like so easy to be distracted and so difficult to, you know, to find a reason to not be distracted. But yeah, we're according to most texts, we're pretty deep in the Kali Yuga right now. And another thing that Tibetans are really fond of saying, yeah, very Tibeto-centric, is that during the darkest point of the dark age, the Buddhist tantric teachings will burn like wildfire. In particular, the Tibetan teachings will burn like wildfire.
Is that metaphorical or the actual piece of paper?
No, it's metaphorical.
Okay.
Metaphorical in that... And a lot of Tibetan teachings, they are not so much trying, like when we're interacting with negative emotions, for example, like desire or anger, not trying to push it away or subdue it, but trying to see the essential nature of it. So, which is inseparable from our own Buddha nature. And so the more emotions we have, the more opportunities we have to recognize this Buddha nature. And so from a certain perspective, the more emotions, the better, if you're diligent enough to train continuously. And so in an age like this, when there's a greater proliferation of negative emotions, these tantric teachings are... very valuable. Yes?
A student of the Buddhism, of the Kogyu lineage, whom I know, with whom I've had discussions, said that from their perspective, what we do, Zazen, is very advanced and difficult practice. For that, from their perspective, there would be many other kinds of practices that would precede our sitting Zazen. Would this accord with what you were saying a moment ago
about Dzogchen?
About Dzogchen, yes.
It depends on what's happening in your mind. It could be, but isn't necessarily.
So if you were able to let your mind, if your mind were free of thoughts like clouds passing through, or relatively if it were just being there, would that be in some way like what you described in Dzogchen?
That would be similar to it.
Yeah.
I think in Dzogchen, the sort of, just to be really sort of concise and to the point, completely awake and not involved with thoughts whatsoever.
How does the Kogyu lineage differ from yours, or does it, or does it have different emphases?
In the Kagyu lineage, they do have different emphases. When they're describing these various vehicles, they'll describe the first three, as I did, and also the three outer tantras, which are the same. They change one of the names, and then the three inner tantras, which are described as three in my presentation, in the Kagyu school, they combine those three as one. And so that's one vehicle in itself. But within that vehicle, there are subdivisions.
Do they do more visualization of deities, or would that be comparable in the
vehicle? They do a lot of the same practices. They do visualizations of deities and chanting their mantras, visualizing, doing a self-visualization of the deity. Also, they're quite famed for meditating on the subtle energies inside the channels in the body, and doing this tummo meditation with the, you know, these steaming robes and whatnot. That in particular is quite famous amongst the Kagyu schools. And I've seen video of nuns doing this around a monastery in Tibet in the middle of winter, and they actually walk in a parade around the monastery, and at each corner there is a big barrel of water, and they get to the barrel, they take off their robes, and so they're standing there naked in the freezing cold. They dunk the robes in, kind of break the ice around them, and then they walk to the other end of the monastery where there's another barrel. And so all the nuns are just sort of circling around the monastery doing this, and then all of the the villagers from anywhere nearby come to watch and gawk. And yes.
In our tradition, we place a high value on doubt as much as faith.
Mm.
And I'm wondering what role doubt or skepticism plays in your tradition, if it is considered part of hindrance or part of vehicle.
It depends on at which point of the path. The Buddha himself said, don't believe this is true just because I said it was. You know, you should examine my words just as a goldsmith examines gold, and there's like various analogies by like cutting it and smelting it, and you know, so on and so forth. I'm not a goldsmith, so But that's a very valuable part of the Tibetan tradition. They talk about study, the sort of trifecta of study, reflection, and meditation. And so studying is like studying philosophy, for example, and learning the words of the Buddha, and studying Buddhist philosophy as taught by past great masters with commentaries by, you know, contemporary masters. And then that contemplative section or component is precisely when all of the doubt and the questioning comes in. And they actually have debate classes at the monastery where the monks train in basically shooting down each other's ideas. And they try and come up with philosophical points or tenets that that no one can shoot down, but they all get shot down anyway. So that can be a valuable, very valuable part of the path. In Tantric Buddhism, it is said that all blessings come from the master, come from the guru. And without sincere trust and faith, the blessings won't trickle down. While one is trying to find a teacher, it is perfectly acceptable to examine and to doubt and to try and suss out what is this teacher's real motivation. You know, are they really, you know, living their entire lives to benefit others? You know, are they really, do they really have this realization that I would like to embody myself? You know, are they really capable of leading me on the path? And at the same time, the teacher is supposed to be doing the same thing towards you. Like, is this student really someone who can follow this path that I'm laying out? And it's sort of like a back and forth. But once in Tantric Buddhism, once we've accepted someone as our teacher, then the time for doubt, at least with regards to the teacher, is past. And from that point on, one is viewing the teacher as the enlightened Buddha himself or herself. And in that way, well, it's taught that if we view our teacher as, you know, a nice guy, then we end up getting the blessings of a nice guy. If we view the teacher as a, you know, a venerable monk or nun, then we get the blessings. We receive the blessings of a venerable monk or nun. If we view the teacher as a great bodhisattva, then we receive the blessings of a great bodhisattva. However, if we view the teacher as the enlightened Buddha, him or herself, then we get the blessings. We receive the blessings of an enlightened being. And so, once we have made the connection and said, will you be my teacher? And the teacher says yes, then the time for doubt is past, and the time for having pure vision towards the teacher has arrived.
Everybody here knows.
Yes, please.
Where is Noah Repa's teachings on the Great Mahamudra? Reflection of the mind ground to him, is that part of the highest Buddhist tantra you talked about?
That when they talk about the highest Buddhist tantra, that is according to the Kagyu schools. Description of the vehicles in which the three inner tantras I described are all included as one. And Milarepa's teachings on Mahamudra, or the Great Seal, are the result is the same as Dzogchen. The path is slightly different. In that, in Dzogchen, they say, this is the end point, this is the result. Got it? And then once you got it, you say, I got it. And then the teacher says, okay, now just get used to that. Whereas in the Kagyu system, they'll first start by saying, first do this meditation, and once you can remain in a certain way for this amount of time, let me know. And then you go come back to the teacher, and the teacher says, okay, now try this next meditation, and then try this next meditation. And it involves more sort of gradual steps.
And in terms of the Mahamudra, a great seal teaching, where is that traditionally taught in the Kagyu system?
Traditionally taught in the Kagyu system. Although these days sometimes Nyingma and Kagyu, there's a lot of similarities, and sometimes it's difficult to tell them apart. The monastery I studied at is called Ka Ning Shedrup Ling, because the two masters who reside there, one is a Kagyu Tulku, or a reincarnated Kagyu master, and one is a Nyingma Tulku, and so it's they're both Kagyu and Nyingma teachers there.
I'm sure you've studied enough Zen to recognize the some similarity in Soto Zen practice between Dipdazo
with
the two Tibetan systems
that yes.
we've been talking about.
Was that a question?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's about time. Maybe we could continue questions outside. Yeah? Thank you very much.
Oh, there we go.